And good evening, and welcome to hour two of our Spokane Public Radio Forum, Confronting Homelessness. We hope to have a thoughtful discussion tonight about the general problem in Spokane, how serious it is, what resources are available to help those in need, and what steps can be done to eliminate it. And we want to talk in some detail about the housing shortage, shortage of affordable housing in our area as well. It's difficult to visit downtown Spokane these days without seeing evidence of an increasing homeless population. The disadvantage seemed to be very visible. In the second hour, we'll take a look at how that population has affected our downtown business community, how one organization has continued to expand its housing options for those in need, one city council member's efforts to solve the problem, as well as efforts to increase affordable housing in our region that are being undertaken in Olympia in the legislature this session. And we also hope to hear from another person who's dealt with homelessness on a personal level. We want to thank our event donors, the Journal of Business, Numerica Credit Union, Providence Health and Services, and also City Cable 5. Let me introduce the panel here. First up, we have Kate Burke, who did policy work in State Senator Andy Billig's office for four legislative sessions. She saw the positive change that could happen through policy and decided to run for Spokane City Council. Kate became a councilwoman at the beginning of 2018 and has been an outspoken progressive voice on the council ever since, and also very involved in homeless issues. Tom Hormel has been a realtor for 21 years. He has served on the Spokane Community Services Housing and Community Development Advisory Committee. He's currently active on the Unlock the Door campaign. That's seeking to increase available housing in the state through various bills currently before the Washington State Legislature. Then we have Dr. Robert J. McCann, President and Chief Executive Officer of Catholic Charities. He oversees 340 employees and over 6,300 volunteers. Some of the Catholic Charities Eastern Washington programs include the House of Charity, St. Margaret's Shelter, Senior Services, Affordable Housing, Counseling, Immigration Services, Childbirth and Parenting Assistance, as well as the St. Anne's Children and Family Center. And then we have Mark Richard, former Spokane County Commissioner, who joined the Downtown Spokane Partnership in January of 2013. He gained an extensive knowledge of Spokane and the surrounding area through his 10 years selling real estate and 5 years as the Government Affairs Director for the Association of Realtors and Spokane Home Builders. Thanks so much, guys, for showing up. I know you have a lot of interesting things to tell us. I think I'm going to start with Kate, because there was actually a question related to your work, Kate, with the homeless. You've been focusing on the homeless issue, but tell us that story that you told me earlier in an earlier interview, how you first became involved with the issue, and you kind of did some informal polling of some of the homeless folks in the community about their needs and such.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, first I'll start off, before I was elected, I was definitely one of those people who would drive by a homeless person and say, don't give them cash because there's enough resources out there. And I'll admit that because, sharing my journey is part of the experience of being an elected official. So, but as I got on council and started, I walked downtown a lot, I would start talking to people who were experiencing homelessness on the street and really finding that there's a real struggle with finding those resources, making them work, and being able to overcome what some of these folks are going through. And so my view changed. I learned a lot. And through that process, I also realized that oftentimes as elected officials and policy writers, we sit in a room similar to this, similar to the people at this table, similar to the people at this table, and not really conversing with the people we're writing policies about or writing policies for. Mm-hmm. And so my intent was to go out and really talk to people who were experiencing homelessness. So I made two different boards full of ideas of what we could do as a city. Do we need those safe lots you were talking about for people living in their cars or RVs? Do we need to do more action for folks experiencing homelessness to get clean? Are they struggling with showers and laundry, lockers, and what type of housing do they want? Do they want transitional housing? Do they want permanent housing to move into right now? Or do they want to maybe camp outside? Are those options that we can provide as a city? And so I took that to the people experiencing homelessness. First of all, with a very overwhelmingly welcoming reception from these people, because they had never been asked by any elected official or somebody higher up what they wanted. And so that was really touching to start making some of those connections with folks. And hearing their voices and being able to take that back to city council and some of the rooms at tables similar to this to say, well, no, I spoke to them and you know, this is what they want. And we should be writing policies around this, and we should be creating places for people to feel safe, whether they're sheltered or unsheltered. And that's just our prerogative as a city. That's what we should be providing. So that was a really extremely great experience for me to really get educated on the topic and really get educated on what the people in our community today need more than ever. And so I just really respected the time that I took up of some of those people's day, and that they were able to share with me the importance of what they needed today and tomorrow. So
okay, and I think I'll ask this one of the group, because before I call up our other woman who had experienced some homelessness, Mara, are you here tonight? Okay, I thought that was you. I'll ask one group question first. Do you folks feel that maybe this is just a more visible problem? I mean, we heard the numbers from the homeless count earlier, and maybe there's a trend that's saying some people are being helped, but it seems to be the public perception that the problem has dramatically increased in the downtown area. I'm just throwing this open to all of you here first. What maybe your read on that? Do you think the problem is no worse than it's ever been, or do you think we're seeing a lot more homelessness in the last year or two? Mark?
Yeah, thanks. I guess as somebody whose job it is to try to make sure that downtown is safe and clean and inviting and thriving and supportive of business, I would say, similar to Kate, when I started this job, I was asked, you know, we have all these complex challenges. How are you going to go about trying to work to solve them? And what I shared with my board, which is what I then subsequently did, was I went out. I said, I'm going to build relationships. I'm going to go out and find out what's going on. I want to ask the experts. I want to get involved in these issues. And so I did. I went and rekindled relationships with folks like Rob, and I met with the vast majority of the service providers in our downtown area, sat with our elected officials, and tried to determine what were the root causes, as Dr. Lutz kind of describes. And so what my experience just in the last 6 years of being downtown is that if you look at the stats, I think we're not seeing a dramatic spike in terms of homelessness, at least that are coming out in the counts. What I think we absolutely are seeing is a greater visibility, and it's something that I'll talk about a little bit later. It's the very small percentage, but very, very visible behavior and actions of folks that are unfortunately finding themselves on our streets because of addiction. Mm-hmm. And I think when you see the railroad or the railroad underpasses, amassed with tents and filth falling over them, and you can't walk down the street without getting encountered with somebody literally walking across the street shouting at the top of their lungs at themselves, and those kinds of interfaces, they just are much more visible. And from our perspective, certainly the biggest concern. We spend a lot of time and energy. We certainly are passionate about helping people, and I'll talk a little bit about that in terms of helping people that are experiencing homelessness. But I think the visibility, in my opinion, it has to do with the behavior that is coming from the unfortunate national crisis that we're in terms of addiction to some of the most heinous drugs that have been ever manufactured.
So in your mind, it's partially a drug issue that's kind of compounding the public perception of what the problem is, where maybe a lot of the people are experiencing financial issues and looking for homes, with this housing crisis thing is sort of separate, or housing crunch,
I feel it
say.
Is, but that's just my perspective. I think that there. I'm not saying that good people that are clean aren't on our streets in downtown, but I mm-hmm. think the vast majority of folks that find themselves on the streets of downtown that certainly kind of rise to the visibility and are creating a lot of the conversation and the visibility piece are because they are, many of them are sadly out of their mind with addiction. I mean, I just think mm-hmm. that to me is certainly compounding the visibility.
Mark, Robert, you work with this daily, and you know, you have the numbers, and your organization houses a lot. I mean, how many folks do you house?
Oh, we've got probably 300 units of chronically homeless housing that we have in downtown right about now.
And would you say that the problem has dramatically increased in recent years?
You know, I think I would say that Mark's right. I would say that if you go into the House of Charity or into any of our homeless programs, you're going to find that about 85% of people are what we call dual diagnosed, which means they have a mental health issue and a substance abuse issue going on at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, as any of us, if we had any of those medical diseases, we wouldn't often be our best selves all the time. Right. I don't have either of those diseases, and I'm not my best self all the time. So, you know, I think that there is a reality of that for the what I work with the most, which is chronic street homeless individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in terms of optics and visibility, I think the first and most important thing is that, and this is what we believe at Catholic Charities, obviously, is that every human being is made in the image and likeness of God. And as such deserves basic dignity and respect and compassion. And at Catholic Charities, what's great is we don't care who your God is, whether it's Yahweh or Christ or Buddha or Allah, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. We serve anybody. If you believe in human dignity, you also have to say that every human being, that includes business owners, that includes downtown hotel owners and restaurant owners, and they deserve dignity and respect as well, and able to do their commerce and have economic vitality for our downtown. They're also a part of this. And so those two groups often collide a little bit, and probably by no ill intention or bad will. It creates some dissonance, it creates some controversy. But I think that in terms of the optics of homelessness, I think what you've seen since last September in downtown is an increase in the visibility. And that's a very simple reason why that's happened. We stopped doing 24/7 shelter. Mm-hmm. House of Charity, which was a shelter built for 109 men only and was only open really for sleeping at night, turned into a shelter for almost two full years that was sleeping 300 to 400 men, women, couples, and their animals every night.
Mm-hmm.
And we were open all day long, 24 hours a day. We never turned anyone away. So there's good news, bad news there. The good news was for 2 years, we went a long way in this community towards solving homelessness. There were very few people sleeping on the streets in those winters. The bad news was that the front of the House of Charity looked like a Woodstock festival some of the times.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really hard on our neighbors, on businesses. It was hard optics for people driving by and not knowing what's going on there. And it looks a little scary to people.
Mm-hmm.
And we were not able to sustain that level of activity in a shelter the size of House of Charity. And as a result, the city and us together made a decision what we really need is a second shelter somewhere downtown to not have everyone in one place. And when 24/7 sheltering closed last September, between then and now, I think you've seen a big influx of people in downtown. I know I've had a lot of people come up to me and say, hey, what's the deal? What's going on? It seems like it's exploding downtown.
Uh-huh.
And for the 2 years previous to that, it seemed okay. And it might have been okay downtown, but it wasn't okay on our block. It was very much a stress on our facility, on our staff, on our neighbors who are business owners and who we want to do the right thing to. We believe in their dignity as well. And so that's created a little bit more visibility. I don't know the numbers have gone up, but the visibility has gone up.
But you say you were working on another 24/7 shelter. Is that correct?
Well, the city is working on another men's shelter for 150 men. We do agree that's the answer, trying to put everyone in one place. It was an experiment. It was a pilot. You know, it had good things and bad things to it, but it was just too many people in one spot. I do think it's the answer to have a second shelter. I think it needs to be located a little bit of a distance from House of Charity, but I think that you could get back to that quasi-solved homelessness. You're not going to end homelessness. As we're sitting here, mm-hmm. someone is becoming newly homeless. Someone is losing their apartment. Someone is fleeing domestic violence. Someone has run the gambit on their couch surfing friends and they've moved into their car. That you're not going to end that, but you can solve homelessness in this community, which means every human person should eat, sleep, and go to the bathroom indoors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a shelter activity for them. And then there's got to be some clear path to permanent supportive housing. That's how you solve homelessness.
Okay. And we're going to get back to all those topics because you brought up a number of
questions.
You bet, Kate.
Oh, I'm so glad you let me. Did you want to answer it?
You go ahead.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to say just the numbers based on the point in time count from the year before last and last year is a 14% increase. So there are numbers going up, and I think it's a nationwide thing that's happening as well. So I do want to note that. I also want to say that with respect to what you both said, I think there's a clear difference between someone experiencing homelessness and someone who has a mental health illness and someone who has a drug addiction problem. Mm-hmm. And we can't put them all together. We can't muddle them into one human being, because that's just not the case out there on the streets. We do this oftentimes, as we say, those people in that category that are dirty and poor and shelterless, that's not the case. If you go serve a meal at the centers around here, you will have perfectly fine, dignifying conversations with normal human beings. It's just that they haven't had a shower in a few days. And so I want to make sure that we don't muddle those things. And also just wanted to note that sometimes when you walk over that filth, those are people's belongings. And so we should keep that in mind too.
Right, good point. And that kind of led into, very good, Kay. Something that I had said when we started this whole event was that every homeless person, regardless of where they are in life, is a real living being that deserves respect, because there's all these individual stories, and even if they were like having some serious drug or whatever problems, they're still people. You know, I want to put a face on this, and we've got another gal here, Mara, who was going to just tell your brief story if you want to come up here for just a sec.
Yeah, my story started in 2003, worst year of my life. There was a bunch of stuff that happened. I was a single mom with a four-year-old, and a back problem left me unable to work or stand. I lost my career of 30 years as a master-level cake artist in the oldest scratch-run bakery in Portland, Oregon. I ended up going back to school and currently have two AA degrees, a bachelor's degree in three-dimensional art, and I am one lesson plan away from a master's degree in teaching. Due to health issues, and the economy in 2010, I quit school to get a job, and I was having troubles at that point. And in that economy, Portland had the highest unemployment rate in the nation at that point when I quit. Mm-hmm. I couldn't even get a job at Walmart part-time at that point. And at that time, 45% of Americans were having to take in family members because of the economy. My prospects for unemployment with the degree were very low, and I kind of just sat down at that point and said, I can't go any further. I then struggled for 4 years couch surfing and working for my rent in other people's homes. In 2014, I went to the streets 2 weeks after having a heart attack and having a stent placed in my heart. A few months prior, a stent was placed in my kidney artery. In January of 2015, VOA placed me in housing, thanks to SNAP and Bob Peeler, and many advocates and activists who helped me at that point. I got help from Transitions, The Hearth. Community Court was a godsend, because I was on a walker and having health problems at that point. I'm a diabetic of 20 years, so mm-hmm. Being on the street as a diabetic is really difficult when you're carrying needles. I was insulin dependent in 2014 when I was on the street, and people kept helping me not go to the shelters because I was carrying needles.
So you got some assistance from, you said, Edie's organization.
Yes.
Correct.
SNAP sent me to VOA, and I've been in housing for 4 years, a little over, and I'm still struggling with health issues that were made 10 times worse by stress and being on the street, plus no sugar control. Food on the street isn't geared to a diabetic. I have been unable to go back to work. I'm having mobility issues still. If I had gotten preventative help when I needed it as a single mom in 2007, I would not be facing the now serious health problems I am currently facing. I shared an article on the Spokane activist pages here last week where they equated a 50-year-old going to the street houseless is equal to health-wise to a 70-year-old in housing. And diabetes and other chronic health issues, and the cost is 10 times what it would be if we had prevention from, it takes a lot less to keep someone in housing than it does to bring them back up off the street.
Right, okay. Sure. Hey, I appreciate you sharing all that with us. I know it's painful for you probably to bring it up, but again, we wanted to kind of present to our audience, both here and on the air, somebody that they might be able to identify with. So
and
thanks so much.
Did I say my name? Because I always forget that at City Council, too.
Mara
Spitzer.
So. Mara Spitzer.
Thank
okay.
You.
Thank you, Mara. Thanks so much. I think I'm going to direct a question to Kate. When you did your little survey, did you hear similar stories of that? Maybe like people that were, you know, initially doing okay and maybe they were hit by double whammy of maybe health bills and or no insurance and or the economic downturn of 08. Was that a theme
yeah,
that
I
you thought, heard?
I think the biggest theme that I heard was just health issues and not being able to cover the payments coming in, even if they had health insurance. Those were unforeseen, right? We don't plan to have unhealthy things happen to us. And not a lot of us have extra money in our savings to be able to withstand some big payments that we need to pay off. And so most of the people that I talked with had that, or they were in process of moving or finalized their move and something happened during that process and really made everything just kind of go away. So most of them were small things like health insurance and health coverage, which most of us feel like we're solid and have all of that together. But and then just those big kind of catastrophes while moving or going through the process of moving or trying to move out and something happening during that as well.
Right. Or even this surprise billing mm-hmm. incident that we've been hearing about with you know, folks go to an emergency room and they think they're covered, but suddenly they find out somebody was out of network or something like that. Yeah, I think I'm going to jump around so everybody doesn't think I'm ignoring him. Tom Hormel, he's kind of the odd man on this panel, odd man out because you're a realtor, but you have been working specifically with this Unlock the Door campaign in Olympia to try to work on the housing issue. Maybe could you give me we heard a little bit about this in the first panel, but to refresh everyone's memory, if they're hearing this as a standalone program, maybe a thumbnail sketch of the lack of affordable homes available statewide and or Spokane. That's your expertise.
Sure. And I can, you know, first I want to say to all the nonprofits out there, you guys do an amazing job. I do sit on the County Health and Services, County Health and Development Advisory Committee, so I get to interact with a lot of you, and it always amazes me. I never knew the need that this community had until I volunteered. And then I was blown away by the need that was there. So all of us walk around in our own little lives not seeing what's really out there. And then something opens those eyes and we're blown away by it. And it blows me away the amount of time and energy and compassion that our nonprofits in this area have. So I just want to say kudos to you. And the second thing is we got to have more compassion for people, for where they are in their life. Whether that's homeless or anywhere in their life, we got to start having more compassion between each other. So that being said, I'll go to the Unlock the Door. And the reason that this is important, a lot of people say, what's the realtor doing on the panel talking about homelessness? Well, it all starts with somebody in housing. And when you talk about the program of housing, the housing is a trickle-up type economy. So, you know, if somebody's buying a $500,000 house, they're typically selling a $250,000 house, and the person buying that house is selling a $150,000 or a $100,000, which is where the affordable housing is. Well, and the person buying that is a first-time home buyer who's moving out of an apartment, which now makes an apartment open for somebody else. So this is all interconnected. Mm-hmm. The Washington Realtors this year, we took an approach and said we are going to go at the legislature with a group of bills attacking affordable and available housing, because that's the issue. It's not just about affordability. And the big question is always, what's affordable? Because I could tell you what I think would be affordable, and there's a lot of people that I could go walk outside and they would tell me that I was crazy thinking that was affordable. But just to let you end on how scarce it is right now, I ran some numbers this morning, and if I looked at $150,000 purchase price, which that's about what a first-time home buyer is looking at, 150 to 200. So if we go even all the way to 200, there's only 69 or 88 total homes available on the market, and only 69 of those in all of Spokane County, and only 69 of those qualify for FHA financing, which is what a first-time home buyer would use. Now, if I run that number down to that 150 number, there was 5 homes available today. I pulled those numbers off of our multiple listing service today. 5. Now, I teach first-time home buyer classes, and in the last month, I taught 2 of them and had 100 people in those 2 classes. They're out. I get to energize them and talk to them about housing, and it's an amazing thing to talk to those folks. And then I send them out to go look at those 5 homes, 100 people. So it is a crisis, but it's a multi-tiered crisis. One of them is the affordability part, which, you know, some of our bills had to deal with condo legislation and taking the liability reform off of the developer. A lot of people don't know that the developers had such great liability that they were having to pull these $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 insurance programs onto their development to build that condo. Well, that, you know, if you're building a 300-unit in downtown Seattle, that cost can be defrayed a little bit. But if you're building a 10-unit in Spokane, that makes that unaffordable. And even in Seattle, it adds to the affordability crisis. Anytime you add a dollar to the purchase price of a house or a condo or anything, that dollar doesn't go to the developer. That dollar doesn't go to everybody. It goes to the person buying that property because it affects the affordability of it. So one of the bills that we're trying to get passed is that condo reform legislation, which would take that off of them. There's a lot to that. If you guys want to go online and read at the state, that bill covers a lot of different things about the defects and things. One of the things that it did was that if you were a condo owners association, you had to sue the developer. Even if the developer agreed to make a fix that a problem was found, you had to sue them. Or later on, you were found liable for it as the homeowners association. So it was just little nonsensical rules that were written into this, which I'm sure were written with great intention, but didn't end up that way. Another bill that we're looking at.
I'm going to just interrupt briefly just to say that if some folks are doubting what would the condos have to do with homeless or low income in Spokane, I also did another interview with Habitat Humanity folks, mm-hmm. and they're partners of this Unlock the Door campaign, and they actually brought that up to me and said, if we had these changes made in Spokane, Habitat for Humanity could build several condos that could house low-income folks. And so there is a correlation between that bill and low income.
Well, and if you can take a 1 acre piece of land and build 4 homes, or you can take that 1 acre piece of land and build 40 condos, the cost of the land was essentially the same. So now you've increased that affordability index on those homes. So one of the other ones is also a GMA density bill, Growth Management Act, GMA. We love our acronyms in the real estate business and in the government business, but it stands for Growth Management Act. That's a bill that's been around for a lot of years. We're hoping to see some changes to that bill in the next legislation. There's some studies going on to change that, but that has to do with the density. And so if you can't build up, and you can't build out, your community starts to die because businesses don't come to a community that's not growing. Amazon's not coming here because any other reason than they see this as a vibrant community that's growing. And yes, that will put some burden on the housing, but it also brings in a lot of money. And it also brings in a lot of other businesses, which add to our entire economy. We just have to figure out how to make all those puzzles fit together, those pieces fit together, and not blame one side or the other. It's not a fault of one business. This is a fault of since 2007, when the housing crisis happened, the National Association of Realtors has ran studies and said that we've built at about 50% of the capacity needed for the growth. Well, that at some points gonna jump up and bite you, and we're now feeling that. So that's that's the start of it. There's also a tiered REIT bill that's going through, and if you guys don't know what REIT, every time you sell a house, you pay what they call a REIT, a real estate excise tax. There's a tiered REIT, and if that bill passes, it could actually mean a lot of good things for Spokane Housing, and because it would lower the cost to sell that home by quite a bit. So there's a lot of great things going. The reason, like I said, the reason that I was put on here is we did this Unlock the Door, which we said we need affordable and available, and we went with this multi-tiered approach, and all of our bills, well, in one way or another, all of those bills are still active in the legislature. None of them have completely passed through yet. The condo reform, that's actually passed through the Senate. It passed through the Senate unanimously. It's now sitting in committee in the House. It's getting hearings. We hope to see that bill get passed through soon. And when people say what do condos have to do, besides even what you talked about with Habitat, what do condos have to do in Spokane? If you don't know this, several of the buildings that were built in Kendall Yards were intended to be condos. But because of the condo legislation and the way that it was written, they got turned into expensive rentals, which, you know, it added to the rental market, but it took away from that housing market, which, like I told you, is that step up. And all of that stuff, as people move up, it empties that lower and makes a home available or an apartment available at the lower end of the spectrum.
What, and this may not fit in with what you're saying, but you were talking about the GMA, Growth Management Act, and different densities. This whole concept of the small, tiny houses, and maybe, Kate, maybe you even know more about that. I mean, how could that work in Spokane? Does it need to be totally changed zoning laws in the city to maybe put in these tiny houses? Anybody here that knows?
I would say yes, it would have to change some zoning laws, because right now there's also an accessory dwelling unit bill, which allows for, if you have if you have a home and you have some property on the backside of that home, there are currently laws that say you could build another accessory dwelling out there. They used to be called a mother-in-law apartment that mm-hmm. you build on there. And I always joke and say a good mother-in-law apartment's in another state, but hopefully nobody heard that. But anyway, and so there's that bill, but it only allows for a certain size based on the amount of land that's there. And so if you're going to talk about tiny houses sound great, but under the current building law, if I could only put two of them on a 5,000 square foot lot, mm-hmm. that's not going to help our problem. That's just going to be really strange looking housing.
Okay. And Kate, have you looked into that at all? And the only reason I'm bringing that up too is because they've apparently have tried a similar tiny housing thing in Olympia, and I'm not sure how they did that.
Yeah.
But
it would take
it
a
might
zone,
be an option.
It would take a zoning change, but like Edie was talking about in Olympia, they did successfully do it. And I think before we would take on that, I would want to make sure that the people who are experiencing homelessness would appreciate something like this. This is an avenue that we should go as a city, because again, I think oftentimes we make decisions with people at this table and we think that it can help people, but really
right.
in all reality, you know, in some communities it can work, in some communities it probably wouldn't work. In Olympia, the people experiencing homelessness came together and built that village themselves.
Okay.
With the help of the city, of course, and funding. I also do know that there are affordable housing agencies that will say go away from that avenue, because it takes away from housing for permanent facilities, but I think we really need to take a holistic approach and make sure that we have every avenue covered, because it's not a one-size-fits-all. Everybody's experiencing a different type of homelessness or a different type of insecurity, and so we need to make sure that we have options for people, and if that's something that could be successful in Spokane, I'd love to look into it.
Mark, go ahead.
Oh, just real briefly. So I think, Kate, maybe you also, but I serve as one of several advisors for Ian Robertson, who's working on tiny housing kind of availability. And I, both in my role in terms of land use and real estate, as well as right now in this role, I think tiny housing does have a role to play for a component. And the thing that I like about Ian's proposal is, but it does require zoning change. It also requires us as a community to embrace and be part of the solution. And what I mean by that is, so imagine you have a 5-acre lot next to your home, and somebody wants to come in and put 30 tiny houses on it. That's quite a density issue. So we all need to be part of the solution, and that includes welcoming, you know, part of that solution into our neighborhood. But the thing I like about his proposal is it provides for individual ownership. And so that individual can also earn their way so they can participate in the construction, the setting of that tiny home, and then they can ultimately end up in the ownership where then they have equity in a piece of real estate that they can turn around and sell and help themselves getting to, you know, to the next point in their life. Maybe it's a little bit larger home that can serve their whole family, for instance. But so I think it's got merit.
Tom?
I was just going to say, it doesn't just require a zoning change. It requires a permitting change because you can't have the same, you know, the same number of permits and the cost of those permits that you do on a single family home hit a tiny home.
That's
because now you drive the affordability back out the window.
Oh.
So this is there's so many moving parts to this that nobody has the one answer. This kind of a situation and these kinds of arenas is where these problems are solved, because we start to figure out, well, sometimes you got to try it, but you don't want to try it on too big of a scale if tiny homes is not what this community wants. But I believe, like Mark said, there is a spot for that. And somebody's got to step up, and the city's got to help that person step up, because you can't always force onto the public, or you can't always force onto private industry things like this. You've got to help them get to this point through our nonprofits and through our city councils and those things, and give them some rebates and some incentives to do that. Because when a builder builds on lots and they have a profit margin, and by the way, people think they're all getting rich. Their builders' profit margins are not that great. I can tell you, I know I work with several that build some low-income housing and their profit margins are 3%. And that's not a lot when they're taking on the risk of a $300,000 house. But if they could build a $300,000 house and make a 3% profit margin, or they can build a $150,000 house and do affordable housing, and that same 3%, it doesn't pencil for them when that lot can take either, and both will sell.
Oh, yeah.
We have to incentivize that to make that happen.
Okay. Hey, let's, Kate, because, boy, we got a million questions here, and I'm going to try to get to more of these cards over here. But I was hoping that Kate could describe. Now, you've been working on, I think initially it was described to me that you were working on a, quote, homeless bill of rights, but I know you have a different name for it.
I do.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because you're going to actually be proposing some legislation to the council and specifics.
Yeah,
correct?
I am. So right now we're still in the draft stages, but I'm bringing forward a series of legislation called the Spokane Promise. It's my intent to let our community members know what, as elected officials and as a city, we want to provide our community members. So this first round of piece of legislation is called the Common Grounds Initiative, and it really just focuses on how do we treat people who are in a very vulnerable state, such as people maybe experiencing homelessness or on the streets, and just goes through kind of some of the key reasons why we have numbers of people on the streets and how we're treating them as community members. I feel like it's going to be a large educational piece of legislation so that we can teach all of our community members what some of these people are going through, rather than just, again, muddling them all into one human being group of those people. So it's going to be a little education to the public as well as people who are legislators. And really, it's a very simple piece of legislation talking about how we should, as a city, be providing places for people to feel safe to sleep at night. And whether that means outside or in a shelter or in a home or in an apartment, we should be providing that safe place. And what does that mean for the city? Well, we don't have places for people to sleep safely in their RVs and in their cars. Mm-hmm. We don't have places for people to sleep outside if that's where they're preferring to sleep. And we shouldn't be dictating, just because they don't have enough money to have a shelter over their head, where they can and cannot sleep. But we can provide places that are safe for them to do that in. And so that's what it talks about. Also brings up the point that we kind of talked about, which I think is a huge public health issue, as well as public restrooms. I mean, come on. How do we move forward?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a human right. It's a human need to go to the bathroom. And right now, it's not a human right. in our community. Mm-hmm. And we've seen this in places like Seattle. Hepatitis C is showing up because people are using alleyways to use the restroom, and that's undignifying and unhumanistic. We should not be treating people like that. And as a city, it should be our prerogative to make sure that we're providing these type of places, whether it's showers, whether it's laundry, whether it's bathrooms, whether it's an outdoor camping spot, whether it's a transitional housing facility or a place to go get sober. Whatever people need to get there, we need to meet them where they are and provide that for them as a city.
So your plan is to kind of just initially start the conversation on this and see maybe individual pieces of it could be passed.
Yeah, so
financing obviously found for it too.
So currently I'm working with a stakeholder group. If anybody in the audience or on the air is interested in joining the stakeholder group, you can do it really easily. You can email me at kateburke@spokanecity.org or write me on Facebook, whatever's easiest. And then we're in the draft form, like I mentioned. So if you want to receive a copy of this, I have copies here today, but for those on air that are not here in person, I can also send those over email, and I'm happy to take input, and I want to make this a holistic piece of legislation that we can really push forward and be prideful of, so that we know as a community that if any of us ever are experiencing any type of struggle, that we're gonna be treated Spokane.
Spokane, okay. Mark, I started to ask you a little bit about the business community's concerns, and you started to tell me a little bit about that. Maybe twofold question, you know, how big of a problem is it for downtown Spokane businesses that are dealing with maybe the bad apples of the homeless community? I mean, is this a real problem for a lot of business owners that are down there? And maybe also, what efforts have some in the business community been doing to try to help with the issue?
I'm going to answer that. I'll answer it very frankly, but I hope that folks in the audience and at home are willing to, just as they're asking us and you're asking me, not to judge. I think you notice when I started my conversation earlier, I was very careful to differentiate between people that are in genuine need and people that are suffering from addiction. And I'm asking for the same respect. I'm asking for you to at least give us a chance instead of I see eye rolling and scoffing and so forth about as if that's all we care about is the bottom line. Beg your pardon?
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We have some of the most generous philanthropers that reside in our downtown that give millions of dollars for great cause. And I will share a few things that I have worked on again, obviously you have to be open to a conversation. You're clearly not. But the issue for downtown is, I think in terms of the challenge, it absolutely is in effect. Why do we need public restrooms? It's because, again, a very small minority of the population. Just I'm asking you to get outside yourself for a minute, go downtown and walk around. We have hundreds of businesses that would love to have their bathrooms open for anybody that wanted to use it. The unfortunate reality is that people will go into that bathroom, they'll lock it up, they will use, they will have sex, they will, instead of using the toilet, they will use the wall. And these are the realities. So it absolutely is affecting business. And business, it can be and is a part of the solution matrix. So we can work together. So let me share with you a few examples. I want to share because some of the heckling and comments in the crowd. So one of the things I heard about 3 years ago from a wonderful woman that works at Frontier Behavioral Health, she had a phenomenal idea, and it's this best practice called SOAR. Only she couldn't get it off the ground on her own. Crystal from Frontier Behavioral Health. So I advocated and I advocated and I advocated, and fortunately Kate and the rest of the council this last summer supported a pilot of almost $100,000 that now has, I think it's two FTEs that are at work, and they are basically executing a best practice in our downtown and in our community, and that is expediting a person's access to supplemental disability income. She brought me this issue, she brought our community this issue, and I rolled up my sleeves and said, we have to have this thing because this is incredibly powerful. You have people with disabilities that are spending 8 years going through a cycle only to get ultimately approved, which means they qualified, but we are asking people with major challenges in their life to navigate through a bureaucracy that is unreal. So the SOAR program expedites that to 3 to 6 months. We have created, and the business community wants to be a part of, but we created an organization now called Hope Works. I searched around the country, found some best practice. I brought it to some of our great nonprofits, and now Rob and his team and Goodwill co-operate this program called Hope Works, where they go out with a van and they engage with a social worker and they provide opportunities for people to engage in employment. But most powerfully is we have a social worker in the van, Goodwill does, that is engaging with them and working on their challenges and helping them get to a better path. And so I think you absolutely will find the downtown community wants to be a part of these solutions. They want to invest their money, they want to invest their time and their passion. They do care. But very important, I think, distinction is that what we are most challenged by is, as I'm going to give you the anecdotal, 15 minutes before I left for this meeting today, okay, I'm sitting at my office and I'm preparing my notes for this meeting. I look out my window because I hear sirens. There is a gentleman, probably, this is classic and typical in our downtown today, and I'm asking you, if this was happening in your neighborhood next to your home, would you tolerate it? Would you want to do something about it? And I believe recovery is part of this. We had a gentleman running down the middle of the street, buck naked, 15 minutes before I left. This is the third time this week we've had a male in his 40s running down the street, buck naked. We had to have five police cars, an EMT vehicle, and a fire truck respond, thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars that have to respond. So why can't we work together to work upstream? As Dr. Lutz says, let's get to the recovery. Let's help that human being off of our street by helping them get clean and sober. So that was just one example. Another one earlier this week, my team witnessed an individual walking a tightrope on the Monroe Street Bridge, because he's higher than a kite on meth and he's literally walking on the rail of the Monroe Street Bridge over the river, probably doesn't know where he's at. And so why is that important? Because we as consumers are making decisions every day about where we feel safe, where do we want to bring our kids and where we want to shop and dine, where do we want to live, where do we want to open a business? Another story, literally just today, a business was interested in opening an 8,000 square foot office. They told the real estate broker anywhere but downtown. Downtown is unclean and it's unsafe. So I'm not saying that we should feel sorry for this business. I'm just saying that business owners are your neighbors. These are your friends, your neighbors, that in their pocket they have dollars they want to spend. They have huge hearts. There's the tax dollars that go to pay for all of these programs, in a large part, come from the business community. So instead of treating them or thinking of them as your adversary, let's break down that divide and work together. I'm here because I want to work together. If I didn't care about the homeless, would you think I'd be here today? I wouldn't be here. I am saying our organization wants to be part of the solution. We can be and we are part of the solution. Final example, Rob came to me about 3 years ago, struggling to find additional resources. He asked me to convene a meeting. This is what we do. We do advocacy. We engage folks to bring around the table to help solve problems. I feel, Rob, you can tell this whether it's accurate or not. I managed to get our county commissioners, a couple of city council members around the boardroom in my office. And I think 3 months later, Rob had a significant additional amount of funding that came both from city council and from the county to help what ultimately led to 24/7 shelter at the HOC. We also put, I think it was $20,000 into the HOC project. We've put $10,000 into Community Corp. We want to be, and we are part of the solution. But as I shared at another event, if the mindset is that business is bad, business is evil, because they are struggling with the addiction that is impacting our downtown, then what you'll find is good-hearted business owners will walk away. They won't be here today. They won't be here to be a part of that solution.
I appreciate your comments, because absolutely. I was thinking while you said that, if it would be the same thing if somebody came out in your neighborhood and you had those same kind of issues. And I realize people want to blame somebody for just about everything. So I appreciate you coming up and saying that. Did you want to make a point, Kate?
I did. I just, I think, again, we're muddling the mental illness and drug addiction and homelessness, and I want to keep them separate. So just to make sure that we're not convoluting every single type of human into one. But I just want to give a shout out to, you guys probably have all seen me at Boots Bakery, and that's where I do my office work for most days, and it's because the owner of Boots lets anybody come in and use the restroom. And
talking about Allison.
Allison.
Right.
And get a cup of coffee, because, you know, everyone needs a cup of coffee. That's what she says. And I asked her one day, I said, why do you let homeless people come in and use your bathroom and get a cup of coffee? She's like, well, I don't see them as homeless. They're just humans, and they don't have money right now. Mm-hmm. And why wouldn't I serve them? And nothing's ever been hurt on her property. In fact, every time I've ever seen anybody come in, they have asked to use the restroom. They have also put in whatever change they have in the jar to get a cup of coffee. Mm. And it is not abused or mistreated in any way. And so, in fact, she said the times that her bathrooms are the worst are Hoop Fest and Bloom's Day. So I think we can all agree to that. But I just want to say there are businesses out there that are working to address these issues. And I think if we had more businesses that were out there that were willing to meet people where they are and show really human dignity and respect, they're going to show it back. Because I don't know if you've ever heard anybody who's experiencing homelessness and what they go through. There's quite a few people in the room here. So if you, you know, want to ask somebody maybe what a day-to-day experience is, I mean, they get spit on. They get snarled at. Mm-hmm. They get scoffed at. People make fun of them. And just because they don't have enough money in their pocketbook to afford a shelter over their head. That is it. That is the only difference. And I can't preach enough that we do have businesses in this community that are wonderful. I suggest, reaching out to Allison and thanking her for her kind heart and spending your money there, because totally some place that I feel respected, and I feel that people get respected there.
Okay.
Too.
Thanks so much, you guys. And thanks for keeping it. It's a very civil discussion here.
Well,
you know what?
If I could
Mark
just,
and I are always civil.
We are. The problem, though, Kate, is unfortunately that isn't always the case. That is the problem. Again, very clear the distinction. Absolutely. First of all, I train my own team. I practice this, which is I get down on my knees and I engage with the homeless on our streets, okay? So I train that and I teach that to my security ambassadors. That's how we work. But when you have the young lady that I brought to the forum last week, who they too serve coffee and they serve pastries, they open their doors, they also serve Lutheran services with all their leftovers for folks in need. They tried to serve. They had their bathroom open. And what they ended up with is people came in, they started stealing from them. And I'm not talking about honest, genuine homeless people. That's not what I'm talking about.
What we're talking about at this forum.
No, but it's both, Kate. It is both. Because it has to be. We have to talk about both. When you have when you have our entire downtown, so where employees up on the 12th floor are asking for security and they're asking for codes to their doors because their employees no longer feel safe. That's the reality, okay? And we cannot not talk about addiction.
I'm going to stop you guys on that topic.
Yeah.
And that was a good discussion. And all I would say is perhaps if maybe some of your initiatives went through, that would maybe alleviate some of these problems that the business community would have to deal with. And like Mark said, the business community may help pay for those very programs. So there we go. I have this many cards, and I've got literally 4 minutes to do these in. I'm going
to
just throw out a couple, and if you have brief answers, thanks so much for being real honest. But no, here's one that I noticed, and really there's so many questions here that are really good. And it seemed like as I would look at the cards, you guys would get on these topics. I don't know if anybody saw, there was a Como News 4 Seattle documentary. I just watched it myself yesterday. And it was about Seattle's approach allowing the tent villages. Mm-hmm. Now, we didn't talk about that yet as being an option, but you alluded to the fact that maybe there'd be a place to park. I looked at this and I thought, well, it's a little bit skewed, but they were saying many long-term unsheltered are because of the addictions and criminal activities support them. And this is the case. I just want to react from this. It is not compassionate to provide help that keeps someone trapped in their dysfunction. Is Spokane keeping an holistic approach that does not enable destructive behavior? And I know, Robert, you kind of deal with this to some extent because, like, you have this the housing first option. You're dealing with folks that are probably using drugs and drinking or whatever. But can you just maybe talk about that angle for a minute? And keep in mind, we only have about 3 minutes left, guys. Sorry, right. We didn't get to all these questions.
I got the gavel right here. We could just call it. I mean, that's fine.
Yeah, we got it. We're doing radio.
No, I think the first thing I'll say is the dialogue about this is very important. Everyone in this room is people of goodwill, and love always wins. And we just need to keep talking about these are very hard issues. There are always going to be people that disagree with us. There's people that disagree with me all the time. Ask my wife, she'll tell you.
She's not one of them.
Yeah, you know, she is one of them. But you know, it's important just to keep talking about it. And it's these are issues that involve human beings who are suffering in very profound ways. And that's always going to make it a difficult conversation. And when you're talking about homelessness especially, you're really talking about people that have suffered for many years. And we heard some of those stories tonight from some wonderful people who shared their path with us. And I think that we just have to be reminded that we're all in this together. And the social service community, the homeless community, the business community, our elected officials, we all have impossible jobs here because this is about the human condition. And there are no perfect answers that fit for everyone. But your question about housing first, I think, is an important one. It's an example of a very controversial thing. Whenever I talk about wet housing, I get a lot of angry letters. The reality is that every single person in Spokane already right now lives in housing first and lives in wet housing. If you want to go and sit in your apartment in your house and drink and use, you probably can do that as long as you can pay your rent and you don't disturb your neighbors to the point where someone calls the police or you get evicted. The housing first model really is designed to have no barriers for people that are very fragile and very vulnerable. And if you'd asked me 15 years ago, and I've been doing this now almost 20 years, but if you asked me 20 years ago, would you take someone out of the House of Charity who's still struggling with addiction and mental health or other issues, and would you give them an apartment? And I'd say, absolutely not. We don't do that at Catholic Charities. Mm-hmm. And now what I'll tell you is there's no other way to do it. And really, you have to meet people where they're at. You have to provide services when they move into housing. There has to be wraparound services for health and well-being and case management and counseling and anything that people might need to keep them in housing. And we're showing that it can be successful. It's not always loved by the whole community. I have plenty of neighbors of buildings that we've built that don't love us and don't love me. But I think the answer is to keep trying and to keep creating units of housing for people that have a path to get out of homelessness, get out of the shelters, get out of the tents, get out of the cars.
Okay, great. Hey, thanks so much to everybody. And I'm glad we had a really good discussion. And I literally hope that something that was said tonight will be helpful to somebody that's in these conditions. And I sincerely apologize I couldn't get through all these questions. So we want to thank all who've been involved in tonight's panel discussion, Confronting Homelessness, put on by Spokane Public Radio. That includes all of our panelists, Tim Sigler, Kay Morano, Edie Rice-Sauer, Dr. Bob Lutz, Rob McKinn, Kate Burt, Tom Hormel, Mark Richard. Also, the two ladies who came up and told their stories, Loretta Greycloud and Mara Spitzer. We would also like to thank City Cable 5 and our engineer, Jay Nordling. Also, our event donors, Numerica Credit Union, the Journal of Business, and Providence Healthcare. And special thanks to the staff and volunteers from Spokane Public Radio who have assisted with tonight's event, and also all of you in the audience who contributed thoughtful questions to the discussion.